Life on this planet thrives so much closer to the least amount of heat, of movement, and energy. Closer to the absolute black stillness of space and death, far from the white of the sun. Polar bears are some of the creatures best adapted to this cold. At minus 20 degrees Celsius, they lie down with their rears to the wind. At minus 40, they cover their faces. At that temperature, metal becomes brittle, vodka freezes, a rose shatters. White fur, black mouths. The bears thrive in the cold, padding slowly across the Arctic.
Writer Audrey Shulman, reading from her new novel, The Cage. She'll be back in just a moment with more from her book, an adventure story about a woman, hungry polar bears, and their encounter on the Canadian tundra. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. In the Canadian province of Manitoba, near the town of Churchill, polar bears gather every fall. They wait for the ice to freeze on the Hudson Bay so that they can stalk out to their hunting grounds. This unforgiving terrain is the backdrop for Audrey Shulman's new novel. It's called The Cage, a story revolving around a young woman on a photographic expedition. Trouble is that Beryl, the heroine of The Cage, doesn't usually work in the wild, and she's never taken pictures of animals larger than deer. She soon finds herself chilled to the bone and face to face with the world's largest land carnivores. And all that stands between her and the polar bears are the protective bars of a small cage. I asked Audrey Shulman to read from her novel.
Absolute zero is minus 273 degrees Celsius. Nothing can get colder or more still. Atoms slow, then stop. That is absolute death, not even the chance for life, for change, or energy at the lowest level. Scientists compete to achieve that coldness in their metals and their labs with large machines, powerful computers. Beryl read about it in the newspaper while she sat in the park along the river. Yet no scientist has theorized an absolute highest temperature, the upper limit for material to exist without exploding into sheer energy. The center of the sun is somewhere around 15 million degrees. With more pressure to hold things together, it could get even hotter than that.
Audrey Shulman, welcome to the National Humanities Center. What a book you have written here.
Oh, thank you.
It's called The Cage. What inspired this book?
I watched a National Geographic episode in which they had a photographer sitting inside of a small metal cage, something like a shark cage. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of polar bears just hanging out outside the cage, the same way that sharks do, that same sort of just prying at the bars, trying to get at the human. And so many things about it interested me. First, that mammals would be as into trying to get to kill and eat a human. That seems like most mammals don't do that. They run away, most of them. And that really interested me. The size difference really interested me. For once, humans were inside of cages instead of animals. And the human was so small, and the bears are just huge. I mean, they can stand 12 feet tall on their hind legs, and they can weigh 2,000 pounds, just about.
Is this an animal rights book, Audrey?
Not really. I mean, I guess I have maybe a slightly different slant on animal rights than it seems a lot of other people do. They tend to believe that animals not only shouldn't be killed, but also probably shouldn't kill, too. Uh-huh. They should probably be kept in some nice little, you know, zoo and be fed food that comes from a package. Whereas I believe very much that animals are meant to do what they're naturally meant to do, to kill and be killed and to live in the environment that they were intended to.
Tell me about how your imagination worked as you wrote this book. You are Canadian by birth. You now live, near Boston.
Right.
So you're familiar with cold weather, but desperate.
Boston being cold in comparison with North Carolina.
Absolutely. but you know, the desperate situation that you put this young woman into, how'd you cook that up in your imagination?
Don't really know. I started off with knowing that this was going to be on the tundra. And therefore, I just began to think a lot about the cold. Uh-huh. I did an enormous amount of research, reading all sorts of books of early searches for the Northwest Passage, where people would just commonly freeze to death.
Well, I won't come back to the research in just a moment, but it occurred to me you must have read Jack London when you were a kid and had nightmares or something about building fires and being lonely.
My whole childhood was spent reading all those adventure books and knowing weird things like you can't drink seawater because, you know, it'll make you insane. It's better to drink your own urine than to drink seawater, unless you do it twice in a row, because then that's it builds up too many toxins, and that's a bad thing. So
tell me what happens in the cage without giving too much away. Mm-hmm. Give our listeners a sense of we begin with this and we end with that. How about it?
It's about the story about Beryl, who's not a traditional hero. First off, she's a heroine, and secondly, she's very small. Instead of being Sylvester Stallone and capable of assembling a gun upside down in the dark or something like that, hanging off a cliff, she can't do much. She's scared of everything. She's scared of botulism. She's scared of car crashes.
But she's small enough to fit into this cage.
Yeah, which is how she gets the job.
Right.
Because they were looking for a professional photographer who could fit inside the cage, which had been designed by mistake to be a little bit too small for most of the people who would normally do it.
So she goes to Churchill, Manitoba, and she meets up with, what, three other main characters, Maggie, who is sort of the town cop.
The town police polar bear cop.
Sure, we'll hear you read about Maggie in just a moment here, but tell me quickly about these other characters.
There's Jean-Claude, who's the quiet and young enigmatic guide for the expedition. He's lived up there for quite a while. There's Butler, who's the macho person who's supposed to write the article in the end for the expedition that's going to be published in a magazine. And there's David, who's the video photographer, who also will have to get inside of the cage, and he happens to be small enough to do that also.
I want you to read to me from your novel, Audrey Shulman. It's called The Cage. Here is a scene where, just before the expedition itself, Beryl, your heroine, has an adventure right there in Churchill with the bears and with the character that we just mentioned. Her name is Maggie.
Ahead, she saw something solid within the shifting of her world. She saw more than one object ahead. If she could only cover her face, she thought, she would be warm. If she could only close her eyes. The first object was a bear, the butt and side of a giant bear, a white bear defined in negative against the blue of the open car door and Maggie's parka lying below. Maggie's black hair poured out of the hood, wet with blood. Maggie's arm waved in the air. Beryl was close. Crawling closer. The bear turned to face Beryl, dropping the front of Maggie's parka from his mouth. He was a giant, yellow with age, a low, mean head moving toward her. His fur ruffled with the wind and the snow he was made of. His eyes narrowed, his teeth white against the black gums of his mouth. She crawled toward him. The bear pushed up and stood to such a height she lost his face in the snow above. She could smell his warm, thick stink of meat and piss and damp fur. He swiped his arms about. She crawled forward toward the heat. She crawled forward into the bow of his body, the bow of his legs. Her head bumped against his testicles, her nose wiggled itself deep within the private heat of his fur until it touched the skin beneath, dry and smooth like talcum powder. She touched her nose to this and breathed deeply of this sanctuary. Her face would warm. She felt the bear stiffen. She felt the fur fly up. She saw the bear above her leaping up into the snow. She was alone. She heard a small noise, a kind of chortle, a kind of snort. She looked all around and then down, and there Maggie laughed as hard as she could with her cheek gaping open, ripped to the bone to show the teeth and gums. Beryl could see the mechanics of laughter in all their glory. Maggie sat up and hugged her. Beryl stilled for a moment within the gesture, then placed her head deep within the hug, deep within the arms, burrowing deep into the warmth. Beryl made a noise like a cough, mouth distorted and unwilling. Maggie began to cry. The tears froze against the skin of her cheeks. The two of them crawled slowly up and into the car. They closed the door and sat. The wind blew outside. There was a silence, a stillness as deep as any Beryl had ever imagined. It poured slowly across her skin until Maggie threw the whole of her leaden weight down onto the horn, and snow by the front bumper pushed back into hotel doors, and people were helping them in.
Audrey, we've just heard you read this hair-raising episode here from your book, The Cage. Anything like this ever happened to you? Is there some autobiography in this book?
Not a bit of it. I've led a very quiet, boring life. I've traveled a bit, but I tend to travel very differently from Beryl. Instead of going out and doing adventuresome things, I go to places like Kenya or Churchill or Japan or Indonesia.
Uh-huh.
But I then just end up being sick. I've barfed on four continents, and I think I'm one of the few people to be able to say that.
Well, you and Graham Greene, now there's a, you have a...
Oh, did he do the same
thing? Oh, he got sick in all sorts of places all over the planet.
Mm-hmm.
What, in this little passage that you've just read us here, are you fundamentally what, telling us a tragedy or a comedy? Is there a reason that the bear didn't just chew these two women up and... You had more book to write, I take it.
Yeah, well, that's always an important thing. You'll notice bad things always happen closer to the end of any book. But it was that I'm trying to show that bears are extremely unpredictable. They're very smart. They're different than many other animals. They're not like seals that will always dive when they see danger, or muskox that will form a circle, something like the settlers used to do.
Yeah, you say that the bears will rise from the bottom of the sea and they will take the seals, throw them, what, 40 or 50 feet into the air?
Mm-hmm.
My goodness.
They're incredibly strong creatures.
Uh-huh.
And they're just unpredictable. They're smart. They can sometimes decide to run away. They'll sometimes track a human. They'll just do whatever.
Audrey, tell me about, to come back to a term we just used here, the research. The authenticity of this book is absolutely wonderful. What these people wear, the cold, the behavior of the bears, you just touched on that, the vehicle that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you put all that together?
I did an awful lot of research. I read a lot of Barry Lopez to get an idea of what the bears were like. Farley Mowat, Joe McGinnis.
Mm-hmm.
I...
Joe McGinnis, the guy who wrote the book about Captain McDonald?
Yes, that guy. He also did a book on going to Alaska and what the people were like there.
Right.
Which I think it's called Going to Extremes.
Did you scare yourself when you were writing this book? I mean, you certainly managed to scare the reader.
No, I never managed to scare myself. I mean, I write it and I'm into it and I'm more there than I am in my normal life.
Uh-huh.
But it never scares me, and I always think it's, you know, it surprised me how much impact it seemed to have on different people.
Have you ever been in one of these buses? The people go out and they take pictures. They look at the polar bears out mm-hmm. there on the tundra, and they take pictures of them. Tell me about that part of the story.
Well, that's once again showing the great difference between Beryl and me. I went out on a bus, and we saw one bear from about a quarter of a mile. It could have been a pillowcase. There's no way you could get any detail on it.
So that's as close as you've ever been to one.
No, actually. I mean, since then, after that, I went and rented a car and went with my little sister out to where there was actually a photographer taking a picture of a bear that was about 30 feet away. And he started telling me this really exciting story. And so I tend to lose track of myself when somebody's telling me a story. And anyway, he kept moving closer to the bear. And in the end, we were about 15 feet from the bear and a long way from the cars. And the bear suddenly looked at us and both of us realized, oh, this is a stupid situation, and ran away.
Now, I want you to read to me again from your novel, The Cage. Here is a scene where we come to the cage itself.
Mm-hmm.
Your heroine, Beryl, is out there on the tundra, and she hasn't been exactly abandoned by these three other characters, David and Butler and Jean-Claude, but she's very much alone in this cage with these bears. Set this up for me.
This is the first time she gets into the cage, so they dump the cage out on the tundra a little bit away from the bus that they'd been traveling in, and the bears are just everywhere all around them. And she gets into the cage and starts to take pictures. The bear's heavy head swung up over the top of the cage and looked down at Beryl. The bear sniffed the metal. She tried to push her snout in. Her massive body filled Beryl's vision. Seated, Beryl felt even smaller. The thick white fur of the bear's chest stuck through the bars in front of her. Hesitantly, Beryl reached one hand out to touch the fur, took a picture of her small black glove against the white tufts of the chest. She was in the cage. Her head hurt. The bear coughed in shock at her touch. Her breath, animal and warm, brushed Beryl's face. She brought her head down and looked at Beryl straight on, eye to eye. Beryl could see the bear's pinkish tear ducts just like a child's. Every hair on Beryl's body stood up with a prickling sweat. Even as it happened, she knew this would be the moment she would remember just before she died. She could feel the cold penetrating slowly from her fingers to her arms. She didn't care any more. She touched the parka over her collarbone. The skins rustled with each breath she took, the breath on which she could taste the clear, frozen air, the warm heat of the bears, the musky smell of wolverine fur, her own body. The bear's nose moved, wet, gleaming ebony skin, the curled inner tunnel shimmering a darker red. The black, drawn-in smile of her mouth pulled back, open, the inside dark as velvet, wet. Beryl realized she'd been moving her hand toward the nose, to touch it, to stroke the small slit openings for the eyes. She felt dazed. She pulled her hand back, checked her position again, tried to breathe more evenly. Her knees and elbows in, head down, no cameras within range of their paws. She placed both her hands on her camera, raised it again, and looked at the bear through the lens.
Audrey Shulman, we've just heard you read from The Cage. Here is the scene where Beryl, your young heroine, confronts the bears for the first time. You've got some unexpected things going on here. There's music playing in the background. Her three colleagues are what? They're chasing the bears off, enticing them what?
They, in order to get the bears away from the bus and the cage so that she can get safely into the cage, they first try shooting guns off into the air to scare the bears away, but bears aren't scared of loud noises. They're used to the cracks of ice and other loud noises.
But American rock music will spook them, huh?
Right. So,
the Marines and Noriega.
they play Puppy Love really loudly, and the bears run like hell. So that was how they got each time they needed to get to the cage. That's how they did it.
Let's come back to the bus itself that these adventuresome people go out on the tundra in. What happens in the middle of the night to create the crisis for them here? The bears go after the bus in what way?
They eat I don't want to ruin the suspense for anybody, but they chew on, they're extremely hungry and very unpredictable, and they chew on the bottom of the bus, on the pipes, which are made of mylar, and puncture it. Both the normal gas tank as well as the reserve tank.
All right, so here these four people are stuck out. Is it four of them? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They're stuck out there on the tundra. Again, without letting the cat out of the bag here, sketch the end of this book here for me.
Well, they have to walk back. They have one radio, but it's hand-powered. They have to crank it, and it doesn't have quite enough power to get civilization from where they are.
Yeah, and the signal gets through to people, what, on the other side of the continent? And here's this sort of this unpredictable element that you're bringing back into this story.
Well, in always reading different true life adventure stories, it always seems as though something really wacky happens that you can't quite understand. So anyway, they do manage, they have a little bit of power left on the bus, and they manage to get hold of some people, but they live in Nova Scotia, I think. And can't understand what the problem is and can't hear them very well.
So they begin this trek. It's 40 miles that they've got to go back to Churchill. They get on the ice. You ever been on thin ice yourself? Literally you, the flesh and blood rider?
I don't think so, except for maybe as a child. But that I'd read a lot of things about it, and so I just sort of described the way seawater has different textures as ice.
Well, Audrey, let's leave these characters out on the ice there so that people who haven't read this book, we won't spoil it for them.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the psychological dimension of your novel, The Cage. Beryl sort of comes to terms with herself. Is this a just another self-help novel at work here?
I think it would be way out of your way to get self-help this way. You'd have to go all the way up to Manitoba. But it starts off with her being very scared, as I said. She's almost incapacitated by the amount of fear that she has. And so she has one almost near-death experience in a car and begins to realize, well, death will happen to her no matter where she is, no matter mm-hmm. how safely she leads her life. So she signs up for this expedition and begins to confront all of her fears and to do all these things that she's never let herself do before.
Well, I must commend you. I mean, you take your reader from Beryl's mind to the actual physical circumstances of the mm-hmm. novel. You take her back in time to her relationship with her parents, mm-hmm. The men in her life. Mm-hmm. Should I ask you if this is autobiographical? Was this novel a sort of coming to terms with yourself exercise?
No, I wish it was, because then I might be more brave. It's not at all. The parents for Beryl are older parents, and she's the only child, and my parents are quite young, and I have three siblings.
Uh-huh. Is the book essentially about survival? If you had to nail it down in a couple of words or a phrase, how do you think about what goes on in this novel?
I think it's coming to terms with nature and with death. The idea that of course, I want to go off on a really long tangent at this point. Americans always seem to love insurance, the idea that and everything they have cannot be taken away from them. But mm-hmm. that's not the way the world works. Everything, the only thing you're guaranteed in life is that everything, including your stereo, will be taken away from you in the end. And the car will get wrecked or will stop working or whatever. So what I'm trying to do is take somebody who very much believes in that sort of life where life is guaranteed, where all your material possessions are guaranteed, uh-huh. and take her to a place where those considerations are no longer important until she can realize that things will get taken away and you just have to live well until they do.
Do you think it's the responsibility of the artist, so to speak, the novelist, to preach these messages to society? How does that work?
Well, it's actually, I've always been amazed by how strong I thought I was preaching, and nobody seems to pick it up. So I don't think that it's actually obnoxious or getting in the way. And I certainly think that writers should be writing their stories with an idea of something they want to change about society. That might be a too straightforward way of saying it. That I don't think ideological feelings should get in the way of the writing.
Audrey, tell me what you're working on these days.
I'm working on something called In Control, which is about a woman at a medical school in Indonesia, a sort of Granada-like expatriate medical school where the students couldn't get into the American schools and so go to an expatriate one in hopes of learning enough information to pass the American boards at mm-hmm. the end.
What are you coming to, the healthcare reform issue here or what?
No, I started writing this book actually like maybe 10 years ago, and it was long before any of the healthcare things had become such an issue. But what I'm trying to talk about is my sister's a veterinarian, and I went to one of her classes where these very nice, very articulate, well-dressed, very socialized people picked up chainsaws and cut cows in half in order to get into the intestines. And I thought there's something really interesting in that, that they can learn that that's okay to do, and when to do it and when not to do it, when to cut up another body and when not to. I mean, it would be a terrible faux pas to be at dinner and, you know, try and cut up your date. It would just be a terrible thing. So they're breaking bounds of social rules, uh-huh. but they're learning also when it's appropriate and when not.
What I'm discovering listening to you talk, Audrey Shulman, at moments it comes through in this book. This is essentially a very serious book, a psychological thriller and adventure story, is that you got a great sense of humor, and you love to sort of poke fun at things. Mm-hmm. I hear you doing that at yourself as we're talking about this novel. Mm-hmm. How about it?
Yeah, although it doesn't necessarily come out much in my writing, I don't think. I tend to joke a lot in my normal life, but most of my writing tends to be...
So a normal life is what you do when you're not writing, is
mm-hmm.
that it?
Yeah. It's I feel a little bit like Batman or something, where I'm Bruce Wayne most of the day, and then suddenly become Batman whenever the call arrives. It's been a weird life.
Audrey Shulman, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Reaction to this book? Are you happy with what the public, the critics, your family members are saying about this thing? How about it?
Yeah, I guess I am pretty much. It's very strange. When I wrote it 6 years ago, and it took 4 years to get published. And during that time, I would try and show it to my friends, and everybody would go like, oh, it's okay. You know. But then since it's gotten published and since it's in that pretty package,
right.
The reviews have been quite good. And my friends and family are suddenly just overwhelmed by it, which I really like.
Well, it's a wonderful adventure story, as I said, and a great psychological thriller.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get a little literary for just a moment here. Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as part of a tradition of adventure writing, psychological writing? You bring together really some odd elements in this book. How about it?
I've been compared in the reviews a lot to Hemingway or to Dickey, who wrote Deliverance,
mm-hmm.
James Dickey. And in some ways it's true. I mean, I use very short, terse writing, and there's a lot of adventure to it. But it's also different. I think I talk more about what she feels, perhaps, than at least Hemingway does. And it's different in that it's showing a small woman, somebody more people, I think, can identify with than somebody who's taken 8 years of karate lessons and speaks seven languages. You
Fair
know.
Enough.
So,
Audrey Shulman's new novel is The Cage. The Cage is available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was novelist Audrey Shulman. Audio tapes of this program are available postpaid for $10. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 745. That's program number 745, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. We're also interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week, listen for a conversation featuring cultural critic Louis Menand of the City University of New York. Louis Menand will be here to talk about the risks and rewards of multiculturalism in American society. Until then, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.